not on the recording, so.
Part two.
Part two. All right. Kind of interesting where we left off. I'm sorry about last week, and thank you, Mike, for filling in. I didn't realize that the date had snuck up on me when I had committed to, as much as I love camping. So we kind of left off, and I kind of think, so I wanted, it's kind of a niche thing for me, so I got to be careful of dragging everybody down this rabbit hole with me. But I wanted Mike.
Which chapter?
We're at the end of 21.
Okay.
Right around verse 15. I'm kind of just filling in from when I left to pick up.
We can't see, so we need it.
Oh, that's. Well, sorry. We need to move all this.
Yeah, it's all right. We got our Bible.
All right,
fine.
Response. We can switch.
All right. Okay. Mike, can you read the Genesis 3:15? Is it? Can you start? Does it start at 14 and go to 15, or is it all 15?
Yeah, well, God said to the serpent, it starts at 14.
Yeah, okay.
So the Lord said to the serpent, because you have done this, you are cursed more than all the cattle and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel.
For the crux of why we're here, the spiritual warfare that we're in, everything hinges on that verse, kind of, in my world. And some things you missed there that we kind of, the Sunday school version and the paintings we see, is that the serpent was not what we know as a serpent up to that point. Right? I mean, Eve talked to this being, and it isn't really a strange undertaking at that point. And he's cursed to crawl on the ground. So I just kind of get the idea that things are going here a little different. That, and the other big point is we accept one half of this equation. I don't know if anybody's a math teacher or studies math in here. You always have to have equal things on both sides of the equal side, the equation. There is a seed of the woman. We completely accept that. Jesus Christ, this is foreshadowing the Messiah. We learn through the Bible as understanding that Satan reads the Bible. He listens to God. He sees everything that's going on, but he doesn't have the Holy Spirit to interpret for him. So he just kind of sees what you would see at a surface level. So all throughout the Bible, the whole story is God said, you know, war, Satan all of a sudden, okay, I got to stop this, right? That's the only thing I can do is stop this from happening. He declares war on mankind, then Abraham, Satan goes after Abraham, all the things he did, then you get them, then the 12 sons, then the tribe of Judah, and Satan's attacks are constantly focused, all the way to the point of then the Magi come to Bethlehem and say, hey, the baby is born in Bethlehem, Ephrathah. The Magi come to Jerusalem, sorry. And they say, hey, the baby's going to be born. And he wipes out all the kids that are less than five, from five and below. So that was Satan's attempt at destroying the seed. The other side of that equation is understand that there will be seeds of the serpent. And I think we kind of forget that side of the equation, and to me, I find that very important. And so I wanted to pick up, and I, as I kind of went through this, without, like I said, I didn't want to drag you down, but this is kind of the crux of the battle that we're in. So it says, once again, there was a battle between the Philistines and Israel. So understand even the fact that this, we've gotten to the point that when Joshua first went into the land, he was to conquer and do this. And this was going to be a done deal. It's approximately, what, Is it 100 years later?
No, because you have all the judges in between. Oh, well, where is that?
Anyway, it's some time in between, and that mission has not been accomplished. So this will be the closing of that chapter. So it says, once again, there was a battle between the Philistines and Israel. David went down with his men to fight against the Philistines and became exhausted. And Ashbi-benab, one of the descendants of Rapha, whose bronze spear had weighed more than 300 shekels and was armed with a new sword, said he would kill David. But Abishai, son of Zeruth, came to David's rescue. He struck the Philistines down and killed them. Then David's men toward him, saying, never again will you go out to battle with us, so the lamp of Israel will not be extinguished. I find this kind of interesting in that when David went out to battle with his men and led his men, they were willing to say, hey, this is a dangerous place for you to be. Why don't you stay home? When David decided on his own that he didn't need to go into the battle, it led to disaster, which will, you know, repercuss throughout history. So there's a big difference here of when you're leading and when you're being, and people see you and say, hey, you're kind of important. We need you to lead us, so don't let this happen. As opposed to you deciding, I'm a leader, I need to stay home and, you know, build my little empire and whatever, you know, many of these people we see on TV or whatever do. So, and even us, I mean, down to us, when you think that you can build your little empire for whatever you're doing, and it's a little different when you're called to leadership and people recognize that. So, in the course of time, there was another battle with the Philistines at Gob. At that time, Shabbekai the Hashatite killed Sath, one of the descendants of Rapha. So you see all these people are descendants of Rapha. In another battle with the Philistines of Gob, Elnan, son of Jair, the Bethlehemite, killed the brother of Goliath the Gittite, who had a spear with a shaft like a weaver's rod. It's still another place, another battle that took place at Gad. There was a huge man with six fingers on each hand and six toes on each hand and foot, 24 in all. He was also descended from Rapha. When he taunted Israel, Jonathan, son of Sema, David's brother, killed him. These were the four descendants of Rapha and Gath, and they fell at the hands of David and his men. So it's kind of the finishing battle of this, and you understand these people are basically the seed of the serpent, right? This is, and I'm going to bring you that case in a little, not that it, again, doesn't affect yourself, but it helps you understand the storyline. And I know sometimes we like to not to be in the battle, if you will. It's comfortable to sit on the sidelines, I guess, but you don't get to sit on the sidelines. You are in this spiritual battle whether you want to be or not. Now, you know, Satan could beat you up enough that you want to sit down and take a break, but it doesn't stop. It's unrelenting. So, you know, I guess the moral of that story is just keep on fighting because it's going to hurt anyway. So you might as well stay in the battle. But so just doing a little bit of research like that. So again, we talked about, in addition to Goliath, David and his men killed four other giants all from Gath. So understand, it's kind of funny, I think I brought it up before, that when we read the story of David and Goliath, you're like, David's this great man of faith, going out and fight. So he goes to the stream and he picks up five rocks. And if you really look at it, you're like, well, that's not an act of faith, because if he thought God was going to kill Goliath, he'd only need a one, right? Yeah, there was four brothers. He was prepared for everybody. That's how much faith he had. And so I was going to read. I just took these from other little books I had. And Ashbi-benab, one of the descendants of the giants, whose spear weighed 300 shekels of bronze, who was armed with a new sword. I think it's kind of interesting that it points out a new sword. I kind of wanted to look into that, but it's it's kind of interesting that they point out he has a new sword. I don't know what the, we're not given the background to that story. If anybody wants to go off and look at that, let me know. And he thought to kill David, but Ashpenai, son of Zeru, came to his aid, then Shimei, and it goes through, and it's David's brother stuck down, so I basically just put back what we just read. Comparing the parallel passage of First Chronicles, so understand Chronicles redoes Samuel, but from a different perspective. Comparing the parallel passage of 1 Chronicles 24 through 8, we observe the following about these giants. Abishai killed the giant Ashbi-Benab. Shebeke killed the giant Saph. The Chronicle says Saphai, which is probably variant of say 9. Ethan killed Goliath the Gittite. It says he struck down Lemmi, the brother of Goliath, and Jonathan killed an unnamed 24-digit giant. Four men were described as Rapha. Rapha translates in the ESV as giants. So we see it because of the list there. 2 Samuel 21, 16, 18, 20, 21. 1 Chronicles 26 and 8. The description of Rapha is related to the word Rephaim, which this is connected, made to the use of plural Rephaim. Spellings of the same name. And uses Rapha once the plural. So I guess the point of that was that these words are kind of interchangeable. One's like, we say deer and a herd of deer, right? So it's Rapha and Raphaim mean the same thing.
Plural.
Right. So as noted above, Rapha is probably a proper name of a giant whom Goliath was descended. To make the connections clear, the Anakim were considered Raphaim. Which makes sense. Goliath and his relatives were associated with both the Anakim and the Rephaim. They were killed by David and his own mighty men, the mighty men of Genesis 6:4. Thus, Goliath represented not just the Philistines, but the dreaded Anakim, which even Joshua could not fully defeat. Goliath and his fellow Anakim were also considered Rephaim, and it gets... And if the Anakim were descended from the Nephilim, and the Nephilim were the children of the fallen angels and women, then this would make Goliath the biological offspring of the serpent. That was where I was trying to get you down to understand. This is all part of that Genesis 3:15. This is,
say that one more time.
Yeah, exactly.
Not the whole thing, but that
last part. That Goliath was the biological offspring of the serpent.
Where are you getting that? Where was the reference?
Well, it's Genesis 3:15. It says, so if Goliath was a son of the Nephilim, and the Nephilim were the fallen angels, then Goliath is the seed of the serpent. So there's a lot of symbolic things going on here.
Is that the same thing in Genesis like 6 when it talks about the sons? The sons of God being fallen angels entering the having relations with the women. Are they the same group? We do believe.
Well, I don't believe it's the same group, but I believe it's the same
principle
of what's happening.
Okay.
And you can get, and again, you can, I've been playing with that for like months, and you can go down a rabbit hole that I could spend 3 months with you guys. And it's not important.
Yeah.
I just wanted you to see, and there's going to be a couple little more facts in here that are kind of interesting to the story, and then we'll get back.
Yes, say one. So in Genesis, when you're talking about verse 4, it says, these were the giants on earth in those days, and also after. And it goes back in.
So there's, you know.
And they did not survive
the flood. Right. Well, and it's funny, if you can listen to all, I've listened to so many theories about that. I don't think, to be honest with you, I don't think anybody has a good answer for that.
Oh, because there were the wives.
Well, but it says that God wiped out, and that, so God's intention, think about this, was to stop this, in theory. That God failed at his mission. And does God ever fail?
No.
Okay. So that's why a lot of the theories, I mean, there was even a theory that one of the Nephilim held on to the side of the ark for 40 days. And I mean, there's so much strange. Right. And that Ham's wife was part. Now, that is just, all of it comes back to knowing God and knowing that if God set out to do a mission and it says and all the, everything was destroyed other than Noah and the other seven people, then to say something else survived is to say God failed. So I don't believe that. And this is the other part I was going to. Goliath's connection to the Nephilim is strengthened by his description as a Gibor, a mighty one. Furthermore, Goliath wore serpent-like scale armor. That was how his armor was described as having scales. So this battle was between the seed of the woman, David, and the seed of the serpent. The giant Gibeon, Nephilim, Anakim, Rephaim, warrior named Goliath. By defeating Goliath and his relatives, David had completed the conquest that Joshua had begun. That was the whole point of that, was this was God, due to their lack of faith and what they couldn't accomplish, this took this many years, and God used David to finally. And it's interesting where these people are concentrated is what would be known now as the Golan Heights and the Gaza Strip. So think how that plays out through history, down to the day.
I think the thing about that is what David did to Goliath at the end. He cut off his head. How did he kill a serpent?
Yeah, he cut off the head of the snake.
And he said he was dead. Well, he was dead when he fell to the ground, but he had to cut off the head of the snake. Very interesting.
And then I just...
That is not the way Maisie kills.
It isn't?
No. She doesn't cut off the head.
She doesn't?
No.
The lawnmowers don't either, but they cut off the head.
So I just copied real quick another version of the Bible. It says, in the Philippines, this is verse 1, Samuel 17. And the Philippines assembled their armies to battle, and they were gathered together at Sukkoth, and which belongs to Judah, and the camp between Sukkoth and Ezahah in Ephesus. And then, I'm sorry, some of these words just do not translate easy in the English. And I don't speak English well either. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and encamped in the valley of Tabernets and set the battle in array against the Philippines. The Philippines. And the Philippines stood on the mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, and the ravine was between them. And there went out a champion from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span, and he had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was clothed with a corset of scales, and the weight of the corset was 5,000 shekels of bronze. So his armor weighed between 120 and 150 pounds, just his armor. So that was my little, without going too far down the rabbit trail, I just wanted to link Genesis 3:15 to what has gone. So basically what happened back to, Satan had a plan, he needs to stop the seed of the woman kind of thing. So he set a minefield in what was promised to Abraham as to be the promised land. He basically set up a minefield there, and so it gives a lot more credence, I feel like, when it sent out the 10 spies and the spies came back and said, we're like grasshoppers to them. It might have been a little more truth to that than we did. We just say, and it is an example of unfaithfulness. But it was them living by sight instead of by faith, because although they were seeing something that might have been much bigger than them, that the faith would have been to step out, and God said, I've given it to you, it's yours, just take it. You don't have to fight the battles I have. And so that's kind of the point of where we've gotten to now. It took all the way to David, uniting the kingdoms and the tribes all together, and all we've been through all this, and there's going to be even more stuff. So now the conquest is complete. The seed of the woman, in this case, has defeated the seed of the serpent. So, on that being said, we're on to 2 Samuel 22. And David spoke to the Lord with words of his song on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hands of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. And he said, the Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. My God, my rock, in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold and my refuge, my savior, you can save me from violence. I call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. For waves of death encompass me, and torrents of destruction assail me. So if anybody can say those words, obviously it's David. Right? We've gone through as a group, we've seen everything he's been through at this point, all the enemies he's run from, the many times he's been surrounded, and every time he's delivered, God has delivered him. The courts of Sheol, verse 6, the courts of Sheol entangled me, and the snares of death confronted me. In my distress, I called upon the Lord. To my God I called. From his temple he heard my voice, and my cry came to his ears. Then the earth reeled and rocked, and the foundation of heavens trembled and quaked because he was angry. So, man, that's a pretty, I mean, knowing what we were just talking about, the God and what his truthfulness and who he is and what we know about him, to know that God is angry, it just has to be just terrifying to whoever or whatever he's angry at. Smoke went up from his nostrils, a devouring fire from his mouth. Glowing coals flamed forth from him. He bowed the heavens and came down. Thick darkness was under his feet. He rode a cherub and flew. He was seen on the wings of the wind. That's kind of an interesting verse. He made darkness around him, his canopy, thick clouds, a gathering of water. Out of the brightness before him, coals of fire flamed forth. And as we know in the Bible, fire is a cleansing symbol. So he's cleansing all the things that he's angry at. So, you know, this is a chance that this happened in history and will happen in history again as we read the book of Revelation. The Lord thundered from heaven. The Most High uttered his voice. Then he sent out arrows and scattered them, lightning and routed them. Then the channels of the sea were seen. The foundations of the world were laid bare at the rebuke of the Lord, at the blast of the breath of his nostril. He sent from on high. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. So kind of the point, I think, that what you get to hear David saying, God can do all this. He's laid the oceans bare. He's, you know, spitting fire, all these things. But he cared enough to stop and get me. It's like, you know, it's just amazing to think about all that's going on, but he cares about the individual. He still cares about you as a person with all that he's going to deal with. Verse 18, he rescued me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me, for they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. This, I will kind of camp on here a little bit because I found it real interesting. He brought me out of a broad case. He rescued me. Why? Because he delighted in me. The Lord dealt with me according to my righteousness. You can see I kind of highlighted that if you look up here. According to the cleanliness of my hands, he rewarded me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and not wickedly departed from God. For all his rules were before me, and from his statutes I did not turn aside. I was but blameless before him, and I kept myself from guilt. And the Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to my cleanliness in his sight. That is, so you go through there and you read, this is completely antithetical to what we know. You have no righteousness. But David's saying, I was dealt with according to my righteousness. He's saying, I was dealt with according to the cleanliness of my hands. This is a guy that killed somebody, that had a covert affair, that failed his family, didn't discipline his sons. All these things have gone on, but he can say all these things, and when you first look at it, you're like, how can he do this? This is kind of blasphemous. But if you look, if you put the two bookends that I put in red in this, because he delighted in me, I am, my cleanliness is in his sight. It has nothing to do with my guilt and what I've done. It's how he sees me because he delights in me. He's willing to forgive all the things in between here and all the things that David has done. And it's kind of interesting how he's still to this day held up in Israel as venerated. And obviously the Lord loved him and took care of him and all that. But David was not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, other than perfect in God's sight, because he was a man after God's own heart, and God delighted in him, and God considered him clean in his sight. So although David's saying all this, my righteousness, this is all accorded to him through the sight of God, not his righteousness. And that's because you can kind of get at this and start saying, oh, I have to do stuff because I have to be righteous. I have to have clean hands. I have to keep all the rules before me. I have to do all these things to be this guy. Well, we all know that nobody can do that. You couldn't last, you know. By the time your feet hit the floor in the morning, chances are I've sinned, all right? So it's like you can't do this. But because he delights in you, because you are a son or daughter of God, he sees nothing but your cleanliness. So, and that's really cool that David kind of brings this out. With all the things he's done, with all the bad things in his life, all his failures, all the things he could have been destroyed for, he's like, I'm good. Me and God are good. I'm clean in his sight. And that's saying something. But, I mean, I know me, and trust me, for the Lord to be able to forgive me for some of my stuff, it's incredible. So verse 26, with the merciful you show yourself merciful, with the blameless man you show yourself blameless, with the purified you deal purely, and with the crooked you make yourself seem torturous. You save the humble people, but your eyes are on the haughty to bring them down. For you, O my lamp, O Lord, and my God, lightens my darkness. For by you I can run against a troop, and by my God I can leap over a wall. It's kind of interesting. You always think about Superman there, right? Can leap over tall buildings and all that stuff. And pretty much with God, you can, you know? And this God, his way is perfect. The word of the Lord proves true. He is a shield for all those who take refuge in him. For who is God but the Lord? And who is a rock except our God? This God is my strong refuge and has made my way blameless. So we see again who all the faults in David's life, it's the Lord who has made his way blameless. He made my feet like the feet of a deer and set me secure on the heights. He trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. He has given me the shield of your salvation, and your gentleness has made me great. You gave me a wide place for my steps under me, and my feet did not slip. I pursued my enemies and destroyed them and did not turn back until they were consumed. I consumed them. I thrust them through so that they did not rise. They fell under my feet. For you equipped me with the strength for battle. You made those who rise against me sink under me. You made my enemies turn their backs to me, those who hated me, and I destroyed them. They looked, but there was none to save. They cried to the Lord, but he did not answer them. And it's kind of interesting. I just back at that. They looked, but there was none to save. They cried to the Lord, but he did not answer them. And, you know, one of the, to me, one of the scariest verses in the Bible was when they're talking to Jesus, said, then we cast out demons in your name, then we do this, and then we do that. And we were reading yesterday in Isaiah, and it says, talking about, they were all like, we were Monday through Friday, or Sunday through Friday for them, they were horrible. And then all of a sudden on the Sabbath, they show up and they're saying all these great prayers, and they're doing it, and they're going, then we do all this stuff, we said our prayers, you know, we fasted on Sunday, we did this, we did that. And the point of it is, That's not what God's looking for. You know, he's not looking for rule keepers. He's looking for people to love, and people for that love him, and he can love them back. And here you see people again, so many people are disillusioned and think, well, they cried to the Lord. So they really did cry out to him, but he didn't hear them. Because there's, and again, there's this person that said, and they said, Lord, Lord, and he said, get behind me, I never knew you. That's some scary soul-searching stuff right there for everybody. Sorry. I could just, it's just verses. If nobody can read them, we can just go on. Let me go back one. Okay. Oh, it's coming back. Technology. When it works, it's great. When it don't, it's true. Went off again. So we'll just skip that. Now I lost my. I thrust them through. So verse 43. I beat them fine as the dust of the earth. I crushed them and stamped them down like the mire of the streets. I think it's kind of interesting that we just read what was part of the curse of the serpent. What did he eat? And it says, I beat them fine as the dust of the earth. I think it's kind of interesting. I just a sidebar, just to go crazy, a little bit of a rabbit hole. We see an interesting thing in the Bible where Satan and Michael are arguing over Moses' body. And, you know, you can say what you want. He said, well, I never... He makes the point that Michael doesn't say anything bad about Satan. He said, the Lord rebuke you. Like, he doesn't... They're making the point, like, don't say bad things about leaders, because God's put leadership where they are. And but part of that, I always laugh at part of the question was, why in the heck would Michael and Satan be fighting over Moses' body? And I think it's kind of interesting, I've heard it put forth, that part of the curse is, think about this, when you die, your soul is gone of one of two places, but all the people that move on to heaven and leave their bodies behind, guess who's stuck dealing with it? The serpent. He's like, you wanted them all the time, they're going to turn to dust. You deal with it. That's your diet. You wanted these people so bad to destroy them, but they're mine. Now you deal with their bodies. You deal with the husk that's left over when they're glorified. I just think that's really cool. I just think it's really interesting. But again, side note, Chris gets off on all kind of and in verse 44, you delivered me from the strife with my people. You kept me as the head of the nations, people with whom I had not served me. So it's kind of interesting. We've just been through. You kind of see that in there. He's like, how many times did Israel rebel against David? You know, at least two we saw. Foreigners came cringing to me. As soon as they heard of me, they obeyed me. Foreigners lost heart and came trembling out of their fortress. The Lord lives, and blessed be my rock, and exalted be my God, the rock of my salvation, the God who gave me vengeance and brought down people under me, who brought me out from my enemies. You exalted me above those who rose against me. You delivered me from men of violence. For this I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations. I will sing praise to your name. Great salvation he brings to his king and shows steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his offspring forever. I think the last verse is kind of cool because we're appointed as kings and queens, it says. And it says he brings great salvation. He brings the kings. In this case, David's talking about just him, but I think we can appropriate that to all of us, you know? And then he just shows steadfast love to his anointed. We are called the anointed, the saints, right? So his love is steadfast that he's appointed to us. So pretty much all the claims that David makes here. I know there's a physical part of this, that David's been in these battles, and David's, you know, the, but we can claim all these things in the spiritual warfare that you're in. You know, he's, all these things apply to you, not just, again, David's applying them to this, some of it to this reality, but we can apply it to this reality and the reality to come, and what's going on behind the scenes that we don't see. I just think that's really important, to never forget that this is, you know, what it is. Do you want me to put the verses back up there, or does anybody? All right. 2 Samuel 23. So this is kind of David's deathbed stuff, and we probably won't get through it, so, but then we can pick it up next week, and this will just about finish the verse. So if anybody else wants to, I guess to bring that up, if anybody else wants to lead or have somewhere a specific book they want to go into or whatever you guys want to do, just come up with a decision and we'll, you know, my feelings won't be hurt if somebody else wants to, you know, do this for a while. It doesn't matter to me. I like doing it, but it's not that, you know, I don't want to hold on to it like some kind of cringe. All right, so these verse, 2 Samuel 23, verse 1. These are the last words of David, the inspired utterance of David, son of Jesse, the utterance of the man exalted by the Most High, and the man anointed by the God of Jacob, and the hero of Israel's songs. The Spirit of the Lord spoke through me, his word was on my tongue. The God of Israel spoke, the Rock of Israel said to me, when one rules over people in righteousness, when he rules in the fear of God, he is like the light of the morning sunrise on a cloudless morning, like the brightness after a rain that brings grass from the earth. I think it's kind of interesting that we're living in probably the exact opposite of that. You know, that the people that rule over us are not righteous. And obviously by what you see going on all around the world, they do not fear God. So we're kind of living in the darkness that's not the morning sunrise of a cloudless morning. It's more like this morning getting up and it was kind of bleak. And but we have a great hope. And I struggle with that. I really do. It's just tough to watch everything. And I guess there's a point of being informed and letting it get to you and just knowing it and understanding that God can take. But sometimes you're like, oh, God, how can you be letting this go on? What is going on? Especially with me with the little kids. You know, with some of the stuff that's going on with this child trafficking and stuff. And I'm just like, but, you know, I guess what God has spoken to my heart and said, are you willing for me to come judge? Because once I start, I can't stop. I can't judge a little bit of sin. I have to judge it all. And that's going to be a very, very tough time, probably even for us to live with what's coming, you know, and in judging your own. Because, I mean, you know, everybody's had that prayer, oh, Lord, show me my heart. And it's like, oh, no, I've seen enough. That's good. We're good. Stop. You know. So I just, it's kind of serious, tough. If my house were not right with God, surely he would not have made with me an everlasting covenant, arranged and secured by every part. Surely he would not bring to fruition my salvation and grant me my every desire. Verse 6, but evil men all to be cast aside like thorns, which are not gathered with the hand. Whoever touches the thorns uses a tool of iron or the shaft of a spear, and they are burned up where they lie. I kind of will end there, but I was thinking, as human beings, even as, you know, we see, I have a little granddaughter and kids and stuff, what one of the things we treasure most is touch. Another human's touch, a loving touch, right? And people that are these thorns that are constantly, I mean, everybody's seen them in their life, I would guess, the people that just strive on strife. It just, for whatever reason, it gets their adrenaline flowing, or just, and if there isn't a problem, they're going to make a problem. And it's just, those people are just the thorns, and you can't touch them. You can't lovingly touch them when they're like that. They're like something that has to be dealt with at a distance, and it lacks human touch. And it's a sad place to be, I think. So that's just what I got in there when it says, whoever touches these thorns uses a tool of iron or the shaft of a spear, they are burned up where they lie. That if those people don't change their ways, and any of us are capable of any of that, then they never receive that love and that human touch that the Lord offers to, you know, to mother you. I mean, it's kind of interesting. As a guy, it's tough, you know, God the Father, and you go through that. But you understand that God built men and women. All the attributes He gave each of us, as I said, He had. He has that motherly love. He has that nurturing instinct where we always kind of separated out that, you know, dad's supposed to be the tough guy and come home and discipline and do the things with the kid, and mom's the loving, nurturing, cooking, you know, all those things. Well, God's all those things. He just separated them out to make you a couple together, a completeness together. And, you know, when we ignore that, or we downplay one side or the other, it's really, really kicking at God and kicking at His design. And if they, and we see that in the world today, that's just gone stark raving mad. And I don't know. I just, watching the news is just tough. So I guess we'll stop there. I wanted to get to right there. I just thought that was, because then from here on, we're going to go through some other stuff with David. We're going to get all his guys and a list. And I guess for posterity's sake, all these guys are mentioned in the Bible for, I don't know, I guess it's been 4,000 years. These guys have probably been, their names have been known. That's pretty impressive. So anybody have any comments? Did I miss anything? Just silliness unabound. Everybody's head spinning. Judy, you okay? Oh, never mind.
You're just lucky I'm keeping
them out. Yeah, I am. We all are.
Your day will come.
I know, you're right. Anybody, comments, anything? I mean, it was, again, me babbling on, and
Yeah.
You still chew up.
I was thinking about David's sin being so grievous that when he, you know, after he got through it, that's what really changed him. That's what really helped him love the Lord even more. And that's why, like, people that don't have big sins, they kind of go through life floating on their little sins, you know. They don't think they need God. But boy, when you see somebody who's had a big sin and it's forgiven and they realize the grace, that's when you turn life around.
And maybe that's why God lets you make those big mistakes. And that brings those big challenges and the giants into your life. And you can either say, hey, man, let's stay out here in the desert. They're too big. Or you can say, hey, let's go. God's got this. And that's easy to sit here and say. It's another thing to really make your feet do it. And anybody? All right, we'll let you guys go. Anybody want to close us in prayer? Volunteers? Or don't make me pick.
I'll close.
There you go.
Dear Father, give these words as food to our heart, that only through you can be fed. And open our hearts to the message that we're going to receive next. And be with the people traveling. And be with this world. Because we need you.
Amen. Amen.